listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Our ongoing coverage of the U.S. attempt to effect regime change in Venezuela continues today, as we take a look at the events of the past few weeks with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Well, we have a really big story that we've been covering. Our audience has already heard a lot of the sound from this past weekend's UN Security Council meeting, from the foreign minister of Venezuela, from the permanent representatives of Russia, China, and Bolivia. In the media here in the U.S., you hear, of course, that, there's a dictator that the people of Venezuela have rejected in the streets in favor of a democratically self-selected president who, by the way, is about to sign over the oil and gold and whatever else he can lay his hands on. We don't hear much in the media here about it, but our audience has heard, some of the primary information. And so, I guess let's start with what exactly is the view from where you are in Nicaragua, where last year you had a coup attempt, at what's happening now in Venezuela?
Yeah, and for us it's very much that Yogi Berra thing, that Yogi Berra deja vu all over again.
Yeah, right.
And it's and Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers of Popular Resistance wrote an excellent summary of the situation in Venezuela, among their opening remarks they emphasized the complete absence of any attempt by the United States authorities to cover up what they're doing. And it's the most blatant coup attempt probably ever, and they just haven't bothered trying to hide what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so, I think Max Blumenthal and is it Ben Norton?
Yeah.
Over at the Grey Zone Project, they've also yes. written an excellent article about who this character Guaido is that the United States have chosen as their figurehead to put forward as the face of a putative Venezuelan democracy.
Yeah, with Dan Cohen and Black Max. I'm sorry, it was Dan Cohen and Max Blumenthal wrote the piece about Guaido. And then, Ben Norton wrote a piece about how this guy right away targets the oil company and wants to do business with the IMF.
Yeah, I get my names mixed up, but and all that material from Kevin Zeith, Margaret Flowers, Dan Cohen, Blumenthal, and Norton, it's all well worth reading to get a good appreciation of what is really going on. Looked at from here, from Nicaragua, there are so many ways of looking at it, and in a way, it's extremely disturbing. Of course, it's disturbing. But one of the things that various people have said to me in different conversations here is that we all agree that it's a sign of the desperation of the United States. And the United States authorities, everything that they've done has completely failed. They've been trying to overthrow Chavismo in Venezuela ever since Comandante Hugo Chavez made clear what his agenda was, a Bolivarian agenda of regional integration, national sovereignty, autonomy, independence. And of course, all of that is complete anathema to the United States. And last year, I've forgotten who it was that was, it wasn't Tillerson, maybe it was Pompeo. I've forgotten who it was, one of the, and they're all interchangeable,
right.
All those. U.S.
Right,
figures,
right.
But one of them made clear in a speech that the Monroe Doctrine was very much alive and well, and they didn't, obviously they didn't say that, but in as many words, but they made very clear that from the United States government point of view, the Monroe Doctrine remained solid U.S. Policy in Latin America and the Caribbean. And so we shouldn't really be surprised about the intensification of the sanctions against Venezuela. And now this latest attempt to try and effectively provoke a civil war in the country, because I find it very puzzling why people outside Venezuela, outside the region generally, And even some people in the region, Guillaume Long, a former foreign ministry official for the government of Rafael Correa in Ecuador, he seemed to think that it's a new development, that there's a strong opposition in Venezuela. Well, there's always been a strong opposition in Venezuela.
Of course.
They've always had about 35, and sometimes depending on which way the flow of feeling and opinion in Venezuela is going, they've always had around 35 to 40%,
right,
electoral support, and they've always had something like 25 to 30% core support. They've
right.
always been strong in that sense.
Right.
What's happened in recent years is that as a result of the sanctions that have been imposed and intensified ever since the death of Hugo Chavez in 2013, there's a lot of frustration among people who had previously voted for Chavismo almost unconditionally. They're now being very seriously affected by the economic sanctions, and feeling is not as strong as it was in terms of support for the agenda of the Venezuelan government and its Bolivarian policies currently being implemented by Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues. So that is why at the moment there is not a clear electoral majority for Chavismo.
Right.
Except that, you know, and if you look at what happened in the elections last year on May the 20th. And there was a low turnout. I think the turnout was 47%.
Right.
And Maduro, Nicolas Maduro won with 67% of the vote?
About two-thirds.
Right, about two-thirds. And that was a crushing victory in electoral terms.
Yes.
And his proportion of the actual electorate was something like 34%.
Or more, but yeah, right.
Yeah, and of the actual electorate, not
Understood.
Those who voted. And
Understood.
So when Western politicians say, oh, well, Nicolas Maduro is a dictator, what they're saying is that they themselves are dictators, because Trump, what did
right.
Trump get?
Right.
26% of the,
if
of
that.
The electorate?
Yeah, because, I mean, you have a couple of metrics that you can apply. One is, you know, 100% of those who are eligible to vote as the electorate, and that's generally what they use as a baseline for turnout. But the realistic baseline for turnout is, in an average election, or even in a hotly contested and a highly high participation election, what's the turnout then? And that is, say, in Venezuela, has been around 80-85%. So that's really the baseline against which you should look at the 43% turnout. And now suddenly, you know, you're talking about more than half of not just likely voters, not even just prime voters, but actual voters, like people that vote, filtering out the people that never vote, in other words, at 15% or so. Now suddenly this two-thirds is, you know, approaching 50% of the whole electorate. Now if you add to the fact that the election was boycotted by the opposition, which is the other half, well, he won because A, the other side didn't show up, that's why he won big, but B, if the other side showed up, he'd have won a little bit anyway.
Yeah, he'd have still, and that's the point.
Right.
And even if, and the United States encouraged the opposition not to participate in the elections, several of the opposition leaders, like Henry Falcon and people like that, ignored the U.S. pressure and took part in the elections.
Right.
And I think a total of 8 or 9 parties actually took part in the elections,
yeah.
And that's what's that? 7 more than in the United States?
Yeah, right. Well, or 9 more.
so the thing is that the talk about dictatorship is ridiculous. So, and we look at that here in Nicaragua, and that we look at that, and it's exactly what happened back in 1984. Exactly the same thing happened
right.
in the 1984 elections here. And the United States ordered the opposition not to take part.
Right.
They didn't. A small section of the opposition rejected U.S. pressure and participated. And in that election, the FSLN won with 67% of the vote.
Right.
Interesting historical parallel, right?
Yeah, well.
So, the nitty-gritty for us here in Nicaragua is that we see this very much as a sign of U.S. the desperation of the U.S. authorities and their allies. So when it's so ironic that when they talk about Venezuela being isolated, and it's the United States and Western Europe that are isolated, because the great majority of countries in the rest of the world recognize the Venezuelan government.
Right.
And I think it was 110 countries that sent representatives to the inauguration of President Nicolas Maduro.
Right.
And so then when you look at it from that point of view, it's classic United States narcissistic exceptionalism, isn't it?
Yes,
they just can't get into their heads that there are other people whose opinions are just as valid as theirs.
Well, if they don't put it on TV, apparently it doesn't exist. This is the mindset that exists here, because they're so used to having monopoly control of the TV camera, and I use the singular there to make the point that whatever we put on television, that's the universe, and nothing else exists. There are TV cameras everywhere now. I mean, part of their project of spying on every human being on the planet and installing a camera outside everybody's house and, you know, hanging one in everyone's posterior is that there are multiple points of view available to people who want to look now, and most of the world has a clue that there was an election last year in Venezuela, that Maduro won that election, that he was inaugurated as president, that the Constitutional Court, the electoral officials, and the Supreme Court all sanctioned the election, all recognized Maduro as the head of the government, and that the decree by that same court of the negation, basically the freezing of the activity of the National Assembly, is valid under their constitution. Most of the world knows this, but not many people have actually said it out loud in the United States, and so these people think nobody knows.
Right. So, but that is a function of the kind of unquestionable decline of the United States. Prestige, but not just its prestige in the world, and its influence in the world. And so, what does it have to resort to in order to get what it wants? And what it's now doing is engaging in outright theft.
Yeah, let me just pile one other thing for you to address, because I see where you're going, and there's something else here. On the altar of this particular project, they are also surrendering what was, a huge asset of theirs, and that is the almost mystical concept of fairness in the banking system of the UK. That if you put your money in the Bank of England, when you go to withdraw it, it's going to be there, and they're going to pay you the interest you contracted for and everything. And instead, Venezuela deposits its gold there, goes to withdraw it, and the Bank of England says, no, you can't have your money.
Well, I think that's a general aspect of the whole Western financial system. For example, even Germany has had difficulty, and I think the United States authorities have refused to repatriate Germany's gold in recent years. I need to check that, but I remember reading that story about 3 years ago. And also, in relation to Venezuela, the Euroclear component of Europe's banking system has hijacked over a $1 billion, I think it's $1.5 billion,
right,
dollars of Venezuelan money.
Right.
And so that kind of decline in the credibility and the trustworthiness of the Western financial system is quite widespread. And I think you're right to note that what's happening now is an intensification of that.
It's almost epical. I mean, the Bank of England suddenly not being looked at as an honest broker, quote unquote, for those who see the world in those terms. That's an epical change. This is something.
Yeah.
This is an item of legitimacy that they've surrendered on this project that is not going to be able to, is not easily going to be regained. And so that is a huge act of desperation from where I sit.
And so there are all these kind of policy decisions affecting the credibility of the United States and its allies as trustworthy partners. I mean, Russia reached that conclusion a couple of years ago, didn't they?
Yeah,
they said
for sure.
The United States is non-agreement capable. The Russian authorities officially stated that. Guillaume Long did an interview with Telesur. It's on the Telesur English program. I didn't find it a very impressive interview. One of the things that he says is that it's like history is accelerating. I think in that, at least, Guillaume Long is right, that what's happening now is that there's an intensification of longer-term processes. Essentially, the decline of the United States vis-a-vis its global rivals, in particular, of course, Russia and China. But look at what they're doing to Venezuela. They tried to do to Iran, and they failed in Iran. Because the Iranian government there has genuine popular support, is a genuinely progressive government on their own terms. Especially within the context of the political and economic arrangements that generally prevail in the Middle East, West Asia, more correctly. So why does the United States think that they're going to have more success in Venezuela?
Yeah, I know.
And they're heading for another defeat in Venezuela. What kind, what shape that defeat will take exactly, we don't know. Will it be a military defeat, as they've suffered in Syria? Will it be an economic defeat, as they've suffered against Iran? And what kind of defeat, or the only discussion that we see here in Nicaragua is, what kind of defeat will the U.S. suffer this time?
Right.
And that's how we see it. And obviously, for the Venezuelan people, it's going to be, and for the region generally, it's going to be extremely painful and unhappy and unpleasant. But it's all the result of this kind of endless hubris on the part of the United States authorities and the elites that control them, you know. And so you started out asking me how we see it from Nicaragua, and
right,
that is how we see it. And while we recognize that in the process a lot of people are going to get hurt and a lot of people are going to suffer, but yeah, you know, That is a decision that the United States has taken.
Right.
It's not the Venezuelan authorities have constantly said that they're prepared to negotiate.
Yeah.
And because they recognize that the opposition opinion in Venezuela has a lot of support. Doesn't have majority support.
Right. That's right.
But it has a significant minority support, and it has to be addressed. And prior to the May 20th elections, the opposition and the Venezuelan government were on the brink of an agreement. But then they were negotiating in the Dominican Republic. And then the opposition received a phone call from Rex Tillerson, who was in Colombia at the time, and he told them to pull out of the agreement on the day they were going to sign it.
Right.
So, and one of the things that I criticize in Guillaume Long's interview is this, he dances around the role of the United States. And of course, what's happening in Venezuela and in the whole region is decisively affected by the role of the United States and its failure to acknowledge that most of the region doesn't want the same that it wants.
Yeah.
And if you look at what happened in the Organization of American States.
Yeah.
In the Organization of American States, was it 10 days ago? Yeah. They tried to bring a vote recognizing Guaido, this usurper clown, as the legitimate president of Venezuela.
Right.
And they failed. They out of the 33 or 34 countries that were voting, 17 voted against.
Right.
And
this is in Washington, by the way. This meeting was held in Washington, D.C. So
right.
just so folks have an understanding of, you know, how the control of the United States is waning. This is the strongest venue that they have. It's headquartered in Washington, D.C., in a building named after Bolivar, in a huge, you know, irony. And they lost the vote there, right in Washington.
Yeah, and then when was it? Was it how many days after the OAS vote did the vote in the UN Security Council?
That was this past Saturday. So it was about 9 days later.
Little over a week, right?
A little over a week, yeah.
So in the United States Security Council, again, the United States lost. There's no international consensus. There's no global consensus. There's not even a regional consensus ratifying U.S. policy against Venezuela.
You know, there was an interesting pregame to the actual proceedings at the Security Council that's worth mentioning. We've covered it. I played the actual sound, I think, earlier this week. But in essence, the fact of a Security Council discussion of Venezuela's situation assumes that someone, the United States in this case, that proposed it, is proposing that Venezuela somehow constitutes a threat to international peace and security, which is the subject matter jurisdiction of the UN Security Council. UN Security Council, international peace and security, that's their domain. So U.S. says, well, what's going on in Venezuela is a threat to international peace and security. Russia says, actually, we would like to have a vote on this question because there is nothing that is going on inside Venezuela that is a threat to international peace and security. However, if you would like an agenda item to discuss the threats to Venezuela that come from outside that constitute a threat to international peace and security, we would like to have a discussion about that. And they had a vote on that. And that vote was 9-4-2. It lost. The U.S. and its allies, it was an interesting sort of roll call on imperialism, basically, in terms of the existing membership of the Security Council.
Right.
You had the three permanent members, the U.S., the U.K., and France, of course, voted for it. And then various U.S. puppets that are part of the 10 other members of the Security Council voted in favor of it. There are three African nations that are on the Security Council. Two of them, South Africa, the lead, but also Equatorial Guinea, voted against it. And then Cote d'Ivoire, which currently has its own usurper president straight out of the IMF sitting there, they abstained. But even they couldn't explain to folks back home supporting this particular situation, particularly given that Gbagbo may be going back there and running against Ouattara sometime soon. So on the ground at the UN before it started, you can see that they were choosing up sides just over the fundamental question of who's responsible for what's going on around Venezuela. And Russia and China, of course, two of the permanent members squarely said it's the United States that's the problem.
Yeah, and now, I think it was yesterday or the day before, the Lima group have made clear that they do not favor military intervention in Venezuela.
Yep, also.
So even the United States' most loyal right-wing allies are rejecting military intervention, at least for the moment,
yeah,
in Venezuela.
And you know, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's one other point I want to make, and then I'll shut up for the remaining 5 minutes. You know, one of the things we've discussed over and over in discussing the region is the one of the genius innovations that came with Hugo Chavez was his understanding that each of the nations there should be respected in choosing whatever government, whatever system that they have for themselves, and being willing to engage on that basis with everyone. That we respect your own domestic politics. It's not our business. If somebody comes after you, we'll stand with you and protect you. Each of these, you know, there's a recognition in that each of these people has to go home and face their own constituencies. And that's why we've seen, for example, some right-wing countries willing to engage in business deals with Venezuela, etc., because these things would actually be popular at home. Well, here you have folks that cannot go home and explain to their own people supporting this character, who's only won 93,000 votes in the election to the National Assembly, as against the president who just won 6.5 million, and also understanding that if they can do it to this guy today, tomorrow, if I won't, you know, wave a parking ticket or whatever for the U.S. ambassador, they might come for me. In other words, the reality of the situation on the ground in the region, it can be seen sort of reflected, if not expressed, in what's happened so far.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. And if you look at what is the timing? Why has the United States decided to do this now?
Mm.
Well, for what my opinion's worth, I think there's a deep reason and there's a more immediate reason. The more immediate reason is that the legislature in Venezuela will come up for election. I'm not sure if it's this year or the following year, but they are obviously not going to be in a stronger position if things had been left alone. They face the possibility of certainly losing their substantial majority that they currently have in the legislature, and possibly even losing the majority altogether. And so the United States and the Venezuelan opposition had a window of 18 months to 2 years in order to do something to preempt Chavismo once again becoming the main force in Venezuela's National Assembly. But so that, and I think that's one of the reasons why the United States has decided to act now. And another reason associated with that is that by provoking this crisis and intensifying the sanctions against Venezuela and stealing Venezuela's resources to the tune of, what's the total now? $7 billion in the United States, a couple of billion in gold in the Bank of England, and you're getting on for around something like $10 billion worth of assets that the United States and its allies have sequestrated, completely illegally, and what that's all about is completely undercutting the successful countermeasures that the Venezuelan authorities have been able to implement all through 2018, last year, and they were getting ready for another raft of measures that would have alleviated greatly the dire economic situation as a result for ordinary people in Venezuela as a result of the United States and allied sanctions. So that is why this is happening now. But there, and I think there's a deeper reason. I'd be interested to know what you think. And I think the deeper reason is basically a rehash of what we were talking about earlier. And the United States probably itself has a window of maybe 2 or 3 years before it itself undergoes a deep social and economic crisis, a deep political crisis, that will completely change what it's able to do on the international scene.
Yeah, and I agree that that's the most likely dynamic at the deep end of it. We have to stop here because we're completely out of time, but that is a good place to pick up this discussion next week and also to start looking around the region there through that lens. So, all right, thanks a lot. We'll speak with you again next week, though.
Thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. When an ISIS affiliate descended upon Nigeria, mercenaries played a major role in pushing the terrorists back. Is outsourcing the name of the game when it comes to modern conflicts? Well, I ask Kobus Klassens, the managing director at Pilgrims Africa and veteran soldier for hire.
Mercenaries have been the mainstay of African wars for decades, having a decisive impact in Sierra Leone, Angola, Nigeria, and other theaters of conflict. And while the media portrays them as dangerous, cash-hungry brutes, local governments still hire soldiers of fortune to get them out of tight spots. Why are small mercenary companies more efficient than regular national armies on this continent? Are private military contractors a viable solution to endless regional conflicts? And could their actions help to bring peace to war-torn hotspots in the long term?
Kobus Klassens, Managing Director at Pilgrims Africa and Executive Outcomes Veteran, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us. Now, Kobus, you run your own security company now after having spent years in the Special Forces and then reached fame as a member of Mercenary Unit Executive Outcomes. There have been TV programs about you. A character based on you was played by Leonardo DiCaprio in Blood Diamond. Are you using all this fame and attention to bring more clients to promote the business? Is this a good thing?
Right. So we all get older, obviously, and we follow different career paths. Let me just rectify something from the start. Not so much Special Forces units as airborne units. Close, but not the same. That's where I spent my military career. And yes, after that, I joined Executive Outcomes, and I had a couple of years with them. And after that, I formed my own company, and then carried on from there. And now, for the last 11, 12 years, It's been Pilgrims Africa, which I'm a shareholder and a director, quite happy to do normal commercial and domestic type of security work.
All right, but what about the media question? Do you like the media attention? Does it help you get clients? Is it a good for is a good thing for business?
No, I don't like. I'm media shy, and so many people in my business. However, I'm one of the older guys around, and I feel that we should have a voice. And if it's a sensible set of questions, we should answer them, and we should speak out for our industry and also for that of the private military business, because we feel that that has a right to exist. It has a place in modern business and politics, and somebody should answer those questions and be on the media. So here I am. Reluctantly, but quite willingly, yes.
So why is it, though? Because other mercenaries from your generation that I talk to, and I've spoken to quite a few, they've said that the media always portrays them in a negative light. Do you feel that sting as well? Do you feel that the public opinion is against you because you're considered a mercenary?
Well thought out, well-balanced media will follow the story regardless. Unfortunately, in the early days of Executive Outcomes, there was a more sinister or a more politically driven agenda that planted stories. This is well documented in Ivan Barlow's research and his subsequent book on that. So to a degree, Executive Outcomes was the victim of a smear campaign, which is different from good reporting. On the other side of the coin, we have enjoyed fair and honest reporting. For example, the BBC reported on our presence in Sierra Leone back in 95, 96, 97 in a very favorable and correct manner, because at the end of that conflict, all parties that was in the conflict was tried or was investigated by the special court, and Executive Outcomes was given a clean bill of health. And this was well reported by the BBC, and it was picked up by other news media. So yes, there's good and bad. We have to live with it. That's our modern world that we live in.
So the private military companies on the continent, like Pilgrims Africa that you're running, they're all based on people like you, South African or other regional army veterans. Is there a new generation coming to replace you guys? Are there young people interested in this kind of work?
All right, let me just make another distinction quickly. Pilgrims Africa is part of the British Pilgrims Group. We are a commercial security firm, well registered. We pay our taxes, and we do nothing that can be considered to be military type of work. But yes, to answer the second part of your question, in private military companies, there certainly is a new generation. Back in the day, it was an exclusive small group, was commonly known as the circuit. Everybody knew each other, and to a degree, people understood the reputation of people, and because of that military action in Iraq and Afghanistan, that led to a whole generation of new young soldiers that left the services and went into the private security work, and many of them found their way into private military companies. The market was flooded, not necessarily with quality people. Many of the guys were good, but many of the guys were not so good, and some of them got kicked out of the military and then also migrated towards a career in the private security industry. So, to be honest, modern security businesses had to catch up with the rest of the world and properly vet candidates and employees and go through the same process as any corporate entity would these days to determine if the candidate sitting in front of them for a job interview is in fact qualified, is in fact experienced, and is in fact the right guy for the job.
So I can see that, you know, you're so experienced in a military world, in a private military world. How do you recruit people? Do you look for physical attributes first and foremost, or mental strengths, or moral fiber? How can you tell without combat testing that a person is solid, reliable, hireable?
Well, there's again two sides to this. To this answer. The first is the commercial security business that is of an international scale, and it has clients that are listed companies all over the world. You know, there's a new international standard for security companies. It's called the PSC1 standard, United Nations driven, and it is client-facing, and it is all about compliance. So as part of that process, We have to be compliant with the way we recruit our personnel, whether we recruit a security guard or whether we recruit a director. So we go through the same recruitment process as any corporate entity would go through. When it comes to a PMC, or rather, let me delve down a little bit into the sort of slightly murkier world of military contracts that is handed out by dodgy governments or by dodgy entities, then it's word of mouth. Normally, they would approach somebody that they trust, or they would have a solution pitched to them by a entity that is registered offshore and that consists out of former military personnel. And those guys would then put word of mouth out. They would use social media, phone calls, emails, and they would gather the guys pretty quickly. In general, they would recruit people they know, but if it's a large contract and there's a lot of guys needed, then obviously sometimes the quality slips a little bit.
So you mentioned that your company mostly does defensive work, and you said that you make a distinction between companies that only do protection jobs and those that also go on the offensive. Do you miss working on a company that can mount offensive operations? Is it more fun to be chopper hopping after, I don't know, Boko Haram in a bush than escorting an oil executive from the airport to the rig and back?
There's all sorts of differences between a commercial security company and a PMC. A commercial security company delivers a wide range of services that borders on logistical services, outsourcing services, technical services. For example, the installation of security measures around a office, CCTV cameras, fencing, lights. It provides man guarding. This is a guard, a front of office guy that sits at a security post, or somebody that patrols a large yard or a fence. Now, on the other hand, the PMC will often engage in combat, and that, for me, is the difference. PMCs don't necessarily engage in combat. PMCs, private military companies, can get involved in the back end proper armies across the world, in a support role. But PMCs are sometimes also involved in combat training, and then in some cases, they get involved in combat. And that, for me, is the main distinction. If you ask me whether I missed the days that I left the army and I'd been part of a private company that engaged in combat, yes. It's a brotherhood, and you do miss it. And it is special, and the bonds that you form back then just stays with you forever. But as you can see, I'm getting older and grayer now. So that is not my number one priority in life anymore.
Did you ever encounter customers that try to misrepresent your mission in any way, to cheat you into doing some downright dirty work?
Oh, no, stories of fiction are made of. To be honest, when a PMC engages with a customer, the contractual requirements are normally laid bare long before any work is done, before any money changes hands. During a mission or during a deployment or during the duration of a contract, yes, the requirements may change, but being tricked into a change, it's never have happened in any operation or any kind of contract that I was involved in. Normally, there would be a bit of give and take. Normally, there would be add-on expectations from the customer. Sometimes, objectives are met by the PMC and not necessarily visible or clear, or the specific objectives that the client wanted. So that would be a process of negotiation. It is a business, after all.
Tell me something. When PMCs have to defeat an enemy on the ground, they act like classic armies. They start with an air onslaught, then finish them on the ground. What are the techniques PMCs use to avoid civilian collateral?
Yes. When a PMC engages in combat, there's no difference between that and any other armed force engaging in combat. The fact that they, for some reason, work for a civilian company or a private company that is there on a contract base makes no difference. Once the bullet starts flying, the same tactics apply. And in each and every case that I have been involved in and that I know of, PMCs took extraordinary measures to avoid collateral damage, specifically the targeting or even the accidental harm to civilians. In most cases, they were greatly successful because they set that as an objective. A standing army that attacks or bombs a target will consider collateral damage, but in a political way. It's not their prime concern, whereas for a PMC, it is very much. So often in the planning of military or combat operations for a PMC where I was involved, the effect and the impact on civilians was front and foremost in the planners' minds. And oftentimes, when there was a chance of civilians getting hurt, the plan was not executed, it was modified in order to avoid that. Like any private business, it considers those things that is bad for business. Having civilians hurt or killed, or having a property damaged that shouldn't be damaged, is definitely bad for business. So therefore, a PMC sometimes considers things in a different way than a standing military would.
We'll take a short break right now. We'll be back discussing outsourcing of war to private companies with Cobus Klaasens, head of Pilgrims Africa and veteran gun for hire. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Cobus Klaasens, head of Pilgrims Africa Security Company and former member of Executive Outcomes, talking about his life as a gun for hire and the role of private military companies on the modern battlefield. So, UN Convention bans the use of mercenaries, while civilian governments use it as a dirty word. And yet we see that time and time again, mercenaries come to the rescue, let's say in Sierra Leone, for instance, against Boko Haram, etc. Why are private military contractors more effective than UN peacekeepers or national armies, for that matter?
Well, again, it comes down to an innovative mix of military strategy and tactics mixed with business principles. So that's where the PMC has an advantage over an army, if I could call it that. They would respond, for example, to a client request in the quickest, most efficient way possible. Political considerations not so much foremost in their planning. Business principles are, if you're getting paid by the hour, then you would make sure that you're as efficient as you can be in that hour. So that's first and foremost where PMCs can be more efficient than militaries. I have to qualify that, though. There's no PMC on this planet that can fight a major war. That's not the point, and that's never where PMCs comes in. At this point in time and into the foreseeable future, PMCs provides a limited yet quick and efficient solution as part of a larger and broader solution. For example, you mentioned Boko Haram here in Nigeria, and I happen to be a Nigerian, and I happen to understand what happened here. The PMC that came here was not contracted to win the whole war. The PMC that came here was contracted to train a unit and to create that from scratch, and then to go into combat and achieve limited objectives so as to show the Nigerian military some initiative, to get them on the front foot, to get some momentum going, and to achieve certain limited objectives. I believe they were contracted initially only to come in and rescue the Chibok girls. You remember the girls that were kidnapped from their school. And that mission then changed eventually and became slightly broader in scope. But it was never the idea that they would stay here for years and fight the war that is meant to be fought by the national army. They were for a specific mission, and that's where some people make the mistake and report wrongly. Nigerian soldiers are brave and physically capable to fight and quite willing to fight. As a matter of fact, they're some of the best in the world. I've fought with them. I can say that. However, their leadership has failed them. Past leadership has degenerated the logistical capability of the Nigerian military, and their training has been lacking behind. So there a PMC can come in, pick up the slack very quickly, restore the training standards and doctrine, at the same time help them with their logistical supply and procurement so that the right things are bought, the things that will matter and will make a difference. Teach them how to use that, help them to deploy that, and then step back and step out of the picture. So a PMC's role is a limited, albeit a very effective one.
So Nigeria continues its struggle with Boko Haram, which is now seemingly split into two factions. Your former colleagues from EO have put Boko Haram on the run 3 years ago, working for the Nigerian government. But seeing that the group is still here, were their efforts not enough? How would you assess?
Well, first of all, the former EO, as you say, Executive Outcomes, was disbanded a long time ago. The company that was contracted to come and help the Nigerian government was a different company. Some of the personalities were the same, but believe me, very few. On the whole, this was a different company, a different bunch of people. And I know because I met some of them and I spoke to them, and obviously we interact on social media and via email and so forth, that they do a good job. They did a brilliant job. They did fantastically well, considering the constraints of time and money. They were given just a part of the budget that they were promised, and they were given a very short period of time, as a matter of fact, over December, to mobilize. And, you know, a mobilization like that would be a logistical effort. And logistics means arms and ammunition. Nobody sells arms and ammunition over December to a private company. Everybody goes on holiday. So they pulled off half a miracle. I say half a miracle because, unfortunately, due to financial constraints, they confined themselves to base and then they left. They withdrew out of Nigeria. It's a great pity that they were not given the opportunity to finish what they were contracted for. I believe they would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives, and Nigeria's northeast would be in a politically far more stable condition than it is right now.
Like a lot of other militants in Africa, Boko Haram is operating in an area where it's easy to cross the border and flee into Chad, Nigeria. Cameroon is facing too much pressure. Can Nigeria even deal with it on its own?
No, I don't think so. Nigeria needs a concentrated effort. It has to be a collaborative effort between Niger, Cameroon and Chad, at least. And Nigeria and all of these other countries needs help. Most of their militaries hark back to conventional days. So their order of battle, their structures, the way they teach their soldiers and train them is in a conventional manner. Unfortunately, they are facing a counterinsurgency or an insurgency enemy, and they need to adopt a counterinsurgency strategy and tactics and equipment and formations. They need help with that. They need to be assisted in order to restructure. The material, the manpower on the ground is fantastic. They're brave, they're strong, they're physically capable, they're nationalistic, they're proud of their countries. They will fight. But they need to be helped how to fight, and they need to be equipped correctly and trained correctly.
I read that back in Sierra Leone, Executive Outcomes was so successful because it was able to get help from local militias who knew the areas and the people. In the fight against Boko Haram, do you see much trust between the military operating in the country's northeast and the locals?
Well, there's an important decision for governments that are faced with an enemy like Boko Haram has to make, and that is whether to enlist civilian help officially. In some countries like Sierra Leone, it was done successfully. The local hunting societies was organized in a paramilitary group, and a part of that was placed under Executive Outcomes control and utilized very effectively. The same can happen here, but first of all, it has to be a political decision by the political leadership of the country. Are we going to arm civilians and put them in harm's way in order to supply and support the military? If they do make that decision, and however wide or limited that decision may be, then those people can be invaluable. As a matter of fact, right now, the fight is carried to Boko Haram and its offspring by local militias that are simply armed with shotguns and the occasional AK-47. But these people are fighting to protect their lands, their villages, and their people. So they are effective in what they are doing in a counterinsurgency role. I think there's scope for that to be organized, well-controlled, well-trained, well-mobilized, and it will certainly add value.
Boko Haram pledged allegiance to ISIS a long time ago, but do you see an ISIS province in Nigeria's northeast as a real possibility at this stage, or is it more like a jihadi pipe dream?
Look, I'm sure there's a technical difference between ISIS, Boko Haram, ISWAP, Al-Qaeda in the Sahel and whatnot. If you take a step back and you look at the problem, it is a militant Islamist problem. They each have a unique character, unique leaders, and maybe slight differences in tactics and an approach to the issue, but it's a common enemy, and it stretches all the way across the region now, and it should be seen as that. So I have no idea whether ISIS would establish a cell here and call themselves that, or that they would ride on the back of the already established Islamist militant movements here. For me, there's an enemy, and it is destabilizing the state. It's killing a lot of innocent people. It needs to be stopped.
Boko Haram reportedly uses child soldiers, and so did the Revolutionary United Front, the group you faced off with in Sierra Leone. Did you ever have to engage a unit that included children? I mean, how tough is it for a soldier to face them on a battlefield? Is the person in his sights a child first and, you know, a soldier second, or vice versa?
Look, in Africa, young people has been combatants forever. In Sierra Leone, we found that immediately. It's really hard for a soldier in a contact situation, in a battle situation, to distinguish the age of the opponent. All he sees is a shadow with a gun firing at him. And he's completely within his rights, and it is internationally his right to defend himself or to attack that objective and kill that person. If it turns out to be a 12-year-old with an AK-47, it's heartbreaking, but unfortunately unavoidable. It has happened, and it will continue to happen, because these are not standing armies. These are not people that play by the rules. Yes, they recruit children. Children are responsible for major atrocities, and they form a significant part of the combat force of Boko Haram and ISWAP. Double tragedy. There's nothing to be done to avoid that. It's a long-term solution. Kids belong in school, not under arms.
You know, conventional armies at this point have been going high-tech with drones, satellites, other hardware in place. Is this high-tech apparel also available to PMCs? Are they using the latest and the hottest, or do you guys just make do with what you've got?
No. What astonishes me is where military technology has gone over the last decade or decade and a half. The fact that a man can sit in a container in the continental United States and direct a drone to kill an enemy halfway around the world at the push of a button is amazing. PMCs definitely do not have access to that level of sophisticated armaments. The best the PMC can hope for is a working GPS, perhaps good radio or satellite communications, and perhaps a little bit better armaments than what the enemy has. But oftentimes it's an even match. AK-47s, heavy machine guns, anti-tank weapons, perhaps the odd helicopter or fixed-wing aircraft or two that makes the difference.
Cobus, thank you very much for this interview. Different to have heard your insight. We're talking to Cobus Klassens, head of Pilgrims Africa and veteran of Executive Outcomes, discussing his life as a soldier for hire and the future of privatized war. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.